Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 169. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on again with Tim Elliott.
We're sending a whole lot of love from Lakeville.
Graham Thickens.
Hey, and the same from Bloomington.
And Phil Jimi Hendrix Wilson.
That is kind of a really lame whole lot of love ripoff.
It really is. It really is.
And our live from the University of Minnesota.
And our very special guest host, Julio Hayde Zapata.
Good morning.
How you guys doing today?
Good. Awesome.
Good. Well, so probably the biggest story, I would say, of this week is, I don't know if you guys have heard of this, social network, but we're going to get to that in a minute. We first have to hear Graham's report from Time, Minnesota.
Well, that's going to be boring when everybody's waiting to hear about Facebook, but no, it was...
nope, he's never heard about Facebook, so...
No.
We hardly even mentioned Facebook last night at this event. It was a panel discussion about startups and mentors, and it was well-attended by 40 to 50 people, and I was moderating the panel of four local startups. We had... couple of fellows from Telemetry Web, which was a Project Skyway startup last year, and one of the co-founders of Needle, the medical-related, pharmaceutical-related startup that is co-based in Minneapolis and New York now, and a fellow from the university, a PhD serial entrepreneur with a biotech startup. His name is Arvind Raghavan, Tycon Bioscience is the startup, and Rob Fugley from Fergus Foods, who has a cool new snack product called Knots, N-O-T-S.
Fergus Falls?
Yeah.
Fergus Foods and Fergus Falls? Fine.
He's kind of a co-based dude, I guess. But it was an excellent discussion about how to find mentors, you know, what's the difference between a mentor, advisor, and a coach, and, you know, how you can use mentors and what value they bring to the early stage startup. It was a really lively discussion. And this Thai group is really something. I mean, you know, it's part of it's the local chapter of an international organization, and in fact, they had their big annual convention going on in Silicon Valley this week called Tycon, and it is a significant organization to support entrepreneurship, and it's largely made up of guys who've done it. You know what I mean? Like senior serial entrepreneur kind of folks who are longtime members of this organization, and there's really a good nucleus of them here in town. I'm not really sure how many members the local chapter has, but Lois Josephson and Paul Taylor also assisted with this event last night, and it was at Argosy University in Eagan, which is quite a place. I wasn't even familiar with this university that offers MBA programs and doctorates in business, pretty impressive facility and people. And it was a very worthwhile event. I'm glad I went. And we'll certainly be attending more of their events in the future. They have an entrepreneur kind of a program where they're sort of trying to coach along some of these entrepreneurs who were on the panel last night had participated in that program. So I would advise people to look into it. It's an excellent organization.
Huh. That's great. Yeah. You know, is there any discussion at these events, and you other guys can weigh in on this too, but is there any discussion on, you know, what are the missing catalysts? I mean, besides money, for startups?
Well, you know, I don't attend all their events, but they do a pretty damn good job of addressing all the issues, and they're certainly bringing together players that can do something about it, you know.
Yeah.
These are not, this isn't a room full of inexperienced newbies. You know what I mean? There's serious business advice in this room, and mentorship is a huge part of what they do. You know, networking, mentorship. You know, and a lot of the when you hear the term mentoring, you know, it's sort of ad hoc, you know, unofficial sort of relationships.
Guy with silver hair putting his arm around you and telling you how it is.
And these entrepreneurs that really said some great things last night, Rob and Neil Tovson from Telemetry Web and Michael Winnikoff from Needle, you know, they really have had relationships with you know, more senior business people that have made a really big difference to them, you know. And, you know, it's not always, you know, hired advisors. That's sort of a different thing. That's where the line between mentor and advisor, you know, is, I guess, is, you know, mentors aren't always hired as advisors, or they aren't always brought in as board members, but sometimes they certainly are. But you know, really what came out of the whole discussion for me was that, you know, networking is everything, you know, to an early stage entrepreneur. It's a lonely, lonely life out there without the support you get from your network. And a large, large part of it comes from mentors. You know, it's going to be, you know, sometimes friends, relatives, you know, friends of your dad who, you know, once ran a built a business, and, you know, people get advice from folks in totally different industries, which can be very valuable. And one of the points that a panelist made was that he really values people that have done different things. You know, like the example was an executive who worked at Pillsbury for many, many years and then just one day quit to launch a totally separate startup of his own, you know, some sort of a lawn tool or something, you know, a consumer product, you know, totally unrelated to food. And so he was saying, you know, he really admires people that can make, you know, these radical career shifts and succeed. And so it was an excellent discussion. And
well, you know what? You know what is interesting is that I've now read two articles, and I'll see if I can find them to put them in the show notes, about the concern that universal healthcare might get nuked because of the fact that it does provide sort of a safety net for people to go off and do startups.
Hmm.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. So who knows? So what's happening then with funding? You know, do you have any kind of a startup?
Well, I've got a couple of things to report. Well, first of all, one of my part-time clients, Assist Me, had a story in the Business Journal this past Friday of raising now a total of more than $500K in angel funding and headed towards more. So that was good news. But I also learned of another client, they've been a friend of mine and not really a client, but KidBlog has had some significant success raising money in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is a secret, but 500 startups has invested in them. At one of three angels or funds in the valley.
It was a secret. You weren't supposed to tell.
Well, I don't think I don't think I'm speaking out of school, but they're well on their way to raising a nice seed round that will get them rolling, and they may even be spending the summer in Silicon Valley to kind of build their ecosystem out there. So that was really good news to hear that.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of other local startups that were out in the valley recently making some significant contacts. The guys at Heroic, which are doing a sort of a TaskRabbit kind of a play, are having some good success. And our friends at Fan Chatter were out in the valley last Friday for the big anniversary party, Y Combinator through on Friday night in Mountain View. And of course, Fan Chatter was a 2009 YC company. So they, yeah, along with all former Y Combinator startups, were invited to this huge party, which I have yet to get the full story on, but I'll bet you it was quite the event. And I think Fan Chatter will have some good things to talk about down the line here.
You know what, though? I mean, you guys, I don't know if we all five of us consider ourselves geeks, but when I think about geeks, I don't think about hardcore partying. It's just me. I mean, I don't know, except for Phil. Maybe we should leave Phil out of this.
God. But. Oh my God, the partying that goes on out in the valley. Did you read the stories that are coming out now about the early days of the TechCrunch party in Harrington's backyard in Atherton? Pretty wild. They do know how to party out there.
Wow. So the big story this week, of course, is Facebook and the Facebook IPO. And you know, Julio, let me ask you, because you look at all this stuff, mm-hmm, and you really take a broad view. And what are your thoughts about the IPO? And I mean, my God, raising $16 billion in the biggest IPO ever?
I take sort of a end user view on that because I'm a consumer tech writer, and I'm watching all of this happen. And the big question that I'm asking myself on behalf of average users is how is this going to change the Facebook experience? And I must confess,
load it up with a lot of advertising.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned how this is going to change the Facebook experience, the Facebook culture. What stuff is going to start coming at me, at a fast clip, as Facebook tries to justify its valuation.
Yeah.
And, I don't like Facebook, to be honest with you. I find the whole experience annoying, and I'm just, I'm watching all of this with a little bit of dread.
I'm the same way.
Perfectly honest with you.
Thank you for saying that, Julio.
Yeah, no kidding.
So well, I didn't know, have to.
Go ahead and hop on Google Plus, guys. That's where everybody is, you know.
Oh yeah,
I have it.
That's the dilemma, isn't it? Because the Google Plus experience is so appealing and clean and well designed and sort of minimalist. I like the way Google Plus is set up so much, and yet the usage doesn't really seem to be there yet, or possibly ever. And
nobody needs it. Nobody needs Google Plus right now. Maybe they will when Facebook has to load up with so much more advertising. But quite frankly, I think that boat may have sailed. I mean, if you look at the increase in Twitter use from a youth standpoint. I mean, my high school and junior high school kids are all about Twitter now, and they tell me all their friends are moving to Twitter, probably partially because of that experience of how complex Facebook is and how it's ever changing. I mean, as a marketer on Facebook, that is a very, very, very frustrating experience because, every day you learn how to do something and the next day it changes. So I think you're going to see the simple down versions. And I don't think Google Plus is necessarily it. I think something that's a lot quicker, a lot easier to deal with, that gives you that opportunity to do short bursts, still share pictures, still keep up with your friends, add to that the celebrity layer that Twitter offers. And I think you're going to see that grow or services like that grow. But I don't think Facebook's going away anytime soon. I think Google's put up a lot from Facebook because so many people use it, and it just becomes such a part of everybody's lives. They'll put up with quite a bit before they bail on it.
Well, I think this is the start of the third decade of the internet. Yahoo, I think, arguably won the first decade. Google certainly has done the second, and I think Facebook, unless they totally screw it up, will be the company that defines the third decade of the internet.
And I had an interesting family experience when I was on my trip. My mother has a Facebook profile, but she never used it. And I was, sitting face to face with her, talking about social media, and I asked her, why don't she use your Facebook profile? Because her town has a Facebook page and all of that, and she never participates in the chat. or anything like that. And she told me that, you know, she got on there and started getting bombarded by friend requests from people she knew, and you know, all the clutter and the advertising and so forth. And she just, my mother is not, she loves her computer. She loves to get on there to do her New York Times crossword puzzle, and all of that. But she just got overwhelmed. And then I was also talking to my sister. My sister wasn't visiting us, but she was in she lives in France. I was talking to her on Skype, and I asked her, you know, because she and I connected on Instagram, and so we got to talking about social media. And I asked her, well, I see you're on Instagram. I don't see you on Facebook. Do you use Facebook or Twitter or anything like that? And she got a stern look on her face. She said, no, I don't want to bother with that stuff. And this struck me. I found this very, you know, very interesting, because it sort of hints at, you know, a little bit of a backlash. You know, people that just they just don't want to bother with the stuff, even though tons of the people that they know are on these networks. Even so, they're just backing away.
Well, yeah. I think there are a lot of people like that, but you know, I'll come back to the fact that the network effect means that you know, there's just this accelerating momentum with Facebook. So, you know, when two people had telephones, it didn't matter. Nobody used it. But when a million people had phones, now all of a sudden, you could call anybody, anybody could call you. And it's the same thing with Facebook. I mean, I got connected to a cousin in Germany, a third cousin. And he approached me because of other connections and said, hey, I think I'm a third cousin. And he gives me some background, ancestral background. It's like, oh, my God. You know, here's a guy, he's 30 years old, and he's a cousin of mine. And I just thought that was awesome. And it's stuff like that where there are people on it. And everybody knows, because I've been really public about it, about my unbelievable resistance to Facebook. And, you know, I mean, it just is what it is. I mean, I don't use the phone that much anymore. Our home phone, for example, but I still have it because everybody in the universe has that home phone number. Mm. And you just got to have it. So I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, but I check it, you know, every day. So
yeah, my mother and I were playing a lot of Upwords, which is sort of a Scrabble like game. And so I was telling her, as I was leaving, you know, heading for the airport, I was telling her, hey, you know what we should do? We should play Words with Friends. But then I suddenly dawned on me, oh, wait. To play Words with Friends, you have to be on Facebook. So that's not going to work.
Yeah. So, Tim, what do you think they're going to do with all that money they're raising?
Well, I think they're going to continue to build the platform out. And I thought it was interesting that Julio made the comments about how complicated Facebook is for, you know, for real people. And I think it's complicated even for us, you know, because as Phil said, trying to stay on top of all the changes that happen on a, you know, daily, weekly basis is difficult. So, you know, something like Path or Instagram or Twitter, which has sort of a minimalism in its functionality, may you know, take off more, and we may see Facebook's popularity flatten out. But you know, but I doubt it. I mean, they're going to get a lot of money, and you know, they already have a good organization now, and I think they're going to be able to make it even better. So I don't think they're going to go anywhere anytime soon. I don't think it's going to become a MySpace sort of situation.
Well, Phil, so or Graham, what do you guys think about the fact that, like, I'm scanning on my Facebook wall right now, and I have one friend who has connected Spotify, so everything he listens to is there. My older sister has, you know, Simply Good For You's photo and Constant Comments photo and Best Quotes photo. And this stuff just flows through because she hasn't turned it off. And as a consequence, the noise is deafening. It's like, I don't want to see everything that they're watching on social cam. I don't want to see everything that they're listening to on Spotify and blah, blah. I don't care. Right. And yet, well, that's so the default.
Go ahead and hide it then.
No, I understand that, but I know I can do that, but then I have to be proactive about that for every single one of these.
Yeah.
Well, every good garden needs to be weeded every once in a while. Yeah, how's that for an analogy?
Yeah, well.
Didn't that sound very, very intelligent?
Kind of.
Let's get back to the IPO. What do you think it's going to do? You think it's going to go up and then plummet as so many of the tech stocks do when they do the IPO? Will it go up and everybody will make their money bail out and then it'll go back down?
I don't think so, because it's one of these things that real people can identify with. So I think a lot of real people want to buy Facebook shares.
Yeah, but they can't.
Yeah, but how many real people can actually get to it? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, they will. So I think that there's going to, the market demand's going to be strong enough that the price will stay fairly close to the offering, maybe a little bit lower, but you know, it will go up for a while before it stabilizes.
So do you get, you suppose if you buy some shares in Facebook, you can get a little icon for your Facebook page that says I'm a shareholder and...
No, they're actually sending out hoodies to all the people.
Yeah, right.
Everybody gets a hoodie. Yeah, there you go.
Everyone gets a hoodie. Yeah. So you can look like Zuckerberg.
I heard somebody say on Twitter, you know, how long will it be before you can just gift somebody a share on Facebook?
Huh.
Yeah. That'll come probably.
Well, I think to your point, Julio, they're going to have to generate revenue. And a lot of it, and they're going to have a growth strategy for generating all that revenue. And the only way to do it is, how do you capitalize on and harvest those, you know, hundreds of millions of people that are on Facebook? And it's got to happen. It's because, you know, it's really fascinating to me about how, you know, all the controversy about GM pulling their ads out of Facebook.
Right.
And yet, I keep saying to people when they have a business-to-business, and they say, geez, do you think we should have a Facebook page? And it's like, look, people are not seeking you when they're in Facebook. They're looking to connect with their family and friends. You know, they want to see what their family and friends are up to. They're not in there saying, gee, I wonder what new cars GM has, or, you know, and I've talked to so many people, and this is all anecdotal, but over and over and over again, I've talked to people and I've said, so what do you think about the ads in Facebook? And they say, what ads?
Oh, God.
They don't even notice them because their brains are turned off.
Yeah.
We got to realize that's the way we are trained not to notice those. We cut those things out. I mean, unless you're looking for something, you're not going to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Facebook has not done a very good job with marketing. And there was a good piece by a senior analyst at Forrester on Forbes, actually, that talked about this, is that, you know, they've got to do a lot better at how they're helping marketers. And you can bet that a portion of that $16 billion that they're raising will be going to solve that, because it has not been a big success as a marketing platform.
Well,
and,
let me,
you know, with 900 and some million users, or whatever it is, 175 or more in the U.S., you know, they've got to be able to do better, or that stock won't do very well.
Well, there was another story about Facebook about the two guys down in Colombia that robbed an internet cafe at gunpoint, but they forgot to log out of Facebook. let me tell you, guys, that I know three people that work at three different Apple stores here in town that laugh over and over and over again when they walk over to a terminal and somebody has forgotten to log out of their Facebook account. And I'm sure you've seen where people, like one guy got on Facebook. This is one of those screens. There's a Tumblr site that does this stuff, and it was all about this guy comes out as gay, and then also says that, you know, he's into bestiality and blah blah blah. And the kid's dad was like, what are you talking about? Well, it turns out after this whole thread that it was somebody that had been using his Facebook account, because the kid left it open at a coffee shop on a terminal. So make sure you log out of Facebook if you're using a public terminal.
Yeah, I use when I'm at an Apple store, I always log on to all my social networks to see to get up to date, and I'm really super paranoid about that, about making sure I log off. One time I did get careless and I walked away, and I was away from that terminal for a good 50 minutes, and then Dunham never logged off, and I sort of dashed back over there, and luckily nobody had used the terminal and was able to log off. It can be a real problem.
Yeah. Well, for here's another big story, And this this story means a lot to me because of all the discussions I've had about Comcast in the past. But they're replacing their usage cap with improved data usage management approaches, and they've talked about raising the cap, and they're starting to roll that out now to a 300 gig cap. And because we do a ton of streaming here in the house with video, I've been blowing through that 250 gig cap now for several months in a row. And apparently there's been some catching of them preferring their network over others. Have you heard that? Did you read that article?
I didn't, no.
Are you talking about them capping apps, third-party apps, but not their own? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what one of the articles that came out talked about. There was an engineer who had examined packets and discovered that the identification of Comcast's packets as preferred over all the other packets was there. Now, whether or not Comcast was taking advantage of that or not remains to be seen, but that there's a way to wrap packets, which allows you to prioritize certain services, and they were in fact doing that.
Well, so I've got to say that I work with Comcast, so, you know, take what I say with a grain of salt here, but
yeah.
You know, basically they're operating in their own private network, and they will use quality of service software to prioritize their own services higher over their own private network.
Right.
Every private network supplier does that.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that they're violating net neutrality. I mean, they're treating all the traffic from the internet exactly the same as they are, and no matter where it comes from. But a lot of people have taken umbrage of the fact that they're prioritizing their own private network traffic above the internet traffic.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's their right to do. In fact, I would be surprised if anybody didn't do that operates a similar network.
Yep. It is their right. And they do need to manage their network because, you know, if you've got people hanging servers off the network, you know, and doing a lot of BitTorrent stuff and all of that, I mean, it just sucks up all the bandwidth and it destroys the experience for everybody else in that little cable loop. But I'll come back to the fact of what I've said before, which is if I don't want to stream from Comcast's servers, which, by the way, don't impact the cap one iota, but I prefer to do Netflix, then I'm have to be cognizant of the cap because they will either charge me more or knock me off if I'm using a service other than theirs. And I don't have a choice. I have no place else to go. There's no other internet service that I can buy for my home or my business that comes anywhere near the speed of cable.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I think it's a choice. And everyone has a choice. And I went from cable to DSL because I didn't want metered internet.
Yep. At any speed here.
So I took that trade-off.
Yep.
And there's DSL and there's cable available throughout the whole metro. And in some places you have things like wireless internet, 4G wireless internet as well. So there are choices, and I think that, you know, all of the suppliers of internet will be responding to the market just like Comcast is in this case, based upon what their customers are doing with it.
Yeah, but there aren't choices. So if I'm in a nice area of Eden Prairie, and the fastest DSL that I can get in my home area is 1.5 megabit per second down and 768 kilobit per second up versus the Comcast cable, which is 16 megabit per second down and 1 megabit per second up, or 2. No, it's 2 up, 16 down, 2 up. And match that speed with wireless. I can't match that speed with anything else. So, for example, I couldn't do the podcast without that kind of bandwidth. Couldn't stream video to two different TVs with that kind of bandwidth. So the bottom line is I don't have any other choice. And much of Comcast's network doesn't have that kind of choice either. Now, if I look at my dad's home in Bloomington, he can get a 12 megabit per second DSL down 20 or even a 40 if he wants to step up to that. So if that was available, then the answer would be yes, I'd have choice. But I don't have choice. If I want any kind of decent bandwidth, I don't have any choice. And so as a consequence, I know Comcast is building or has built great data centers in Denver and the Twin Cities and one other location, and that they can deliver their stuff theoretically better and faster and so forth. But I got to be aware of what I'm streaming on Netflix because they're going to cut me off or they're going to charge me more unless I use their stuff.
But if you use a lot more electricity or water than your neighbors, don't you pay more?
Yeah, I do, but here's the difference. The difference is, the energy company or the water from the city, they don't own the, the devices and so forth. They're not offering, a competing service. That's not even a good analogy. A better analogy is, if you own the toll road, and you essentially slow down all the rest of the trucks, but you also own a trucking company and your trucks don't even have to go through they can sail right on through a special lane. And they don't have to pay any extra fees. Now your costs are lower and your speed is higher because you own both the highway, the toll road and the trucking company. And that's the position Comcast is in. And that's what I have a hard time with. So,
yeah, I hear what you're saying. Be that as it may, I think we have it pretty good in the Twin Cities because my parents are just on the very edge of a DSL service area. I had to scream bloody murder to get the DSL. The only broadband option in their area was that DSL provider. They had to scream bloody murder to get them to hook up. And the service is, they advertise 1.6 megabits, and they're often the speed test often shows, a fraction of that, making it impossible to do any streaming video whatsoever. And so here in the metro, I think there's room for improvement, but I think it's we have it pretty good compared to some other parts of the country.
Yeah.
I wanted to. There was one weird thing that I was talking to my parents about this, and they told me that trucks went down the road, literally almost spitting distance from their front door. Trucks went down the road laying fiber where they live in New Hampshire. See if you can give me any perspective on this. Because there's obviously fiber in the ground here in the Twin Cities too. Fiber was laid, literally a stone's throw from where they have breakfast. And yet they can only get, 1.6 megabits, via standard, what is it that you have to be near a certain facility to get service? I forget what it's called.
You have to be near the switch.
Switch, yeah.
So for DSL, and
they have a switch down about 3 miles down the road from where they live. Yet the fiber, they can almost reach out and touch where the fiber is laid in the ground, and I'm not even sure I know what I'm talking about here. But why can't a direct connection be made to that fiber, because that fiber is transmitting data at blinding speeds.
I'll tell you exactly why. Out on Mitchell Road, so from my house, I can actually see the box that's sitting out by this cell tower.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's 1,500 feet to maybe 2,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
They laid fiber. And so I talked, this is before CenturyLink bought Qwest.
Right.
And I talked to the guys, and the guy says, yeah, we're dropping fiber down here for this switch and for this cell tower. because it lowers, like, apparently lowers costs dramatically. Mm-hmm. I said, great. Are you guys gonna run fiber into the neighborhoods here? Oh, no, that's way too expensive. So I ended up calling Quest, and I ended up talking to a guy who was a VP of, you know, operations or something, and said, here's where I am and here's how far away I am. And I'm curious if I can get fiber to my house. And he said, yeah, but you've got to buy the premise equipment, and you'd also have to pay for the fiber to be pulled through the street all the way to your home. Yeah. So it'd be, anyway, the punchline was it was about $14,000.
Wow.
So if I was willing to pay $14,000, I could have him pull the fiber all the way and then get the premise equipment on the side of my house. So, you know, it's just that the cost is for them is just way, way, way too high for them to run fiber to the home. Unlike a Verizon, you know, the density in the Northeast is so dramatically higher than it is here that they can afford to pull fiber because they're offering television services. They're essentially competing with cable and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Haven't they slowed down though? I think Verizon has slowed down with Fios in their deployments.
I haven't seen anything. Yeah. I don't know, but
It is expensive.
It's not a reason for me to move to New York City. I'll guarantee you that. I'd much rather be living here. I'll take the slower speeds.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing about Comcast is the service is just rock solid, and it's fast and it works. And I have hardly any, I mean, I've had it for, I don't know, 7 years, and I've had virtually no issues. You know, maybe three or four that I've ever had to even deal with. And, you know, so there's huge advantages to that. Anyway, let's segue into gadgets. Cause you know, speaking of Verizon, speaking of bandwidth, you know, Verizon came out and said that they were going to basically be nuking their unlimited plans as they roll out LTE. And now we talked about gadgets last week, and Julio, really interested in what you think about some of the stuff happening with mobile phones, like the Galaxy S3, the One X and S, and so on, and the whole bandwidth thing. You know, it's like it's almost as though as more and more of us are getting these devices, we're actually using them, and there's just not enough bandwidth out there. You know, they can't build enough towers and so forth. And so, anyway, let's talk about these. Phones, for example, which one would you pick out of the Galaxy S3 and the One X and S?
Which one would I pick?
Yeah, if you were to pick one of these.
I
strictly limited to the Android platform. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So Phil and I both have Android, and we're both up for renewal. You know, for an upgrade. So you know that these look like the flagship devices at the moment. So should we upgrade, or should we wait until the next iPhone, or wait until the next Nexus devices that are rumored to be coming from five different manufacturers sometime later in the year?
Or build a hut somewhere in the woods and just turn off.
Yeah, or just keep our old Android phones.
And wear a hoodie.
And work on our Kaczynski manifesto.
Yes. Yes.
Hey, they still work. My 2-year-old phone still works fine.
Yeah.
Mine as well.
The phone that I really like right at the moment is the One X. And I am an AT&T customer. Although, you know, when I've recommended phones to people, most of the people who are asking me, you know, I want to get into a smartphone. What do you recommend? My answer is always, you know, first, you know, pick the carrier that best suits your needs. And for people in the metro who want rock solid service in the metro and are also going to be venturing out state quite a bit, I always tell them go Verizon, because the LTE in the Twin Cities is amazing, and you get decent coverage outside in the outstate areas, which you don't with AT&T. And so I always tell people start with your carrier and then pick your phone after that. But you know, things are changing. LTE from AT&T is going to debut in the Twin Cities this year. I have it on good authority. And the maddening thing with Android phones is, you know, a really sweet phone might come out, but invariably it's an exclusive to that carrier, and you often have difficulty finding comparable handsets and other carriers. Like, for instance, AT&T has the 1X, T-Mobile has the 1S. The 1S and the 1X are not comparable. The 1S, very nice phone, but it's inferior to the 1X. I took the 1S too on my trip and had a good time with it, but I wish I had had the 1X with me instead of the 1S.
So besides size, because I know the 1X is quite a bit larger than the S, what makes it so much better?
Well, the 1X has a superior screen technology. The S, if you look at it, if you look at like text very carefully, you can see that it's distorted. It has a different screen technology. I'm drawing a blank on the name. It's Pentile or something along those lines. So the quality of the screen technology on the 1X and the 1S is dramatically different. The 1X also slightly larger. A little more horsepower under the hood, as I understand it. The 1X is I had borrowed it briefly from AT&T before I went on my trip, although they wouldn't let me keep it to take on the trip, which was a bummer. And I really love that phone. And two things that the 1X and the 1S have in common are very, very extremely good cameras. The cameras are very the sensors very good. The responsiveness is great. You can do a lot of you can do some really interesting burst photography stuff. There's a lot of filters and adjustments you can make to your shots. And so I used the S, the 1S, as one of my two primary cameras on my trip. I didn't take a standalone camera at all. I took two phones. I took the iPhone 4S and I took the 1S. And the 1S was roughly comparable. You know, if I really had to choose between the two, I'd still go with the iPhone because the quality of the pictures was subtly superior. And I didn't have as many. It's a lot easier to like tap on the screen of an iPhone to focus on particular parts of your framed shot. It's a little easier to do that with the iPhone than with the 1S. But you know, on balance, they're pretty comparable. And so it's really it's been a while, but we're finally getting to the point where you can buy a decent Android phone and be secure in your photography options, because I talked to a lot of people that have Android phones that are, you know, 2-3 years old, you know, old Droids and things, and they're bitterly, bitterly disappointed with their cameras. And you know, going forward, that is changing for the better in a very significant way.
Yeah, I was one of those guys that definitely was. I've never been a big fan of my phone's camera and the 4G, the Evo 4G LTE, or the Evo 4G. That's the LTE that's coming out, right, Tim? Mm-hmm. Which is the X in Sprint clothing, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
With the LTE network that is not deployed yet.
That doesn't exist. Yeah.
And you lose WiMAX too, so you get to go to the fabulous 3G network that Sprint operates.
Which I'm used to, because that's pretty much all I use in Lakeville. The 4G is patchy at best. So, Julio, you know, we all know you're an Apple fanboy. God love you. what do you think about the very strong rumor, almost a confirmation, that Apple will be going to a larger screen size in the iPhone 5?
I don't have any inside information on that, but my informed speculation is that Apple will keep the physical size of the handset roughly the same, because I think that's pretty close to perfect, and I think it knows that it's pretty close to perfect, and I think it scoffs at Android makers that are making their phones bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where they're almost tablets. And I saw a poll. I can't remember where I saw this, or I would have put it on the show notes. But one guy speculated in a fascinating way how Apple can keep the form factor of the physical form factor of the phone exactly the same, but sort of stretch out the screen so that it makes, you know, full use of the vertical and the horizontal, which it doesn't currently. So it could basically constrain the dimensions of the screen, but expand them so that the screen overall is physically larger, yet still has the same pixel density.
Well, one quick funny aside is, there. I don't know if you saw the picture of the guy and it was all staged, but he was standing in line holding a high def TV that had a screen on it that looked like an Android interface, you know, with all the buttons and stuff.
Funny.
It was great. I'll see if I can find it because it was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. So, well, I think it was only a matter of time before the iPhone was going to, you know, hop on the larger screen size. But still, even if it's not a larger screen, it is still so darn easy to read and so darn easy to see. I mean, I I've got the Evo 4G and I've got a very substantial screen. It's a 4.3, and I still think that I look at the screen on the iPhone and it's still a great screen.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what really bothers me is I just bought this new iPad, and now there's rumors of the new 15-inch MacBook Pro, which will have a new faster SSD in it and all kinds of other goodies, maybe a Retina display, and then a new iPhone 5, and I'm thinking, I can't buy all this stuff, even though
there's all. Yes, you can. You always do.
Oh,
God. What do you mean that you can't? You always do. For God's sakes.
Oh, geez. Well... Yeah, it's like the guy that I saw that did the tweet that when something new came out from Apple just said that he should just give Apple access to his checkbook so they can do an automatic deduction.
Yeah.
That was great.
We know that drill.
So any new news on the Google front in terms of them offering a phone that they may offer an unlocked Android phone for some incredible price?
Well, as we spoke a week or two ago, they are selling the Galaxy Nexus, the GSM model right now on their website. I think it's $400 or $500 unlocked, something like that. And there's rumors that they will be selling other Nexus devices from a number of manufacturers instead of just picking one as they've done for the past several years. And there's also rumor that they'll be directly selling tablets too. So I'm sure, Julio, you've seen all that speculation. They did this once before with the Nexus One and retracted. Do you think they have any kind of chance of selling mobile phones directly and bypassing carriers?
Well, I'm sure they'll try again. I think it's. It's a wet dream for people like Google to be able to sort of break the headlock that carriers have and to sort of find a different way to do this that isn't so carrier dependent. And so I think they're eager to give it another go. Whether it's going to work, that remains to be seen. Especially on the tablet front, there's talk of Google offering its own tablet. And I'd be very interested to see where that goes, because Android tablets in terms of market share are just nowhere at this point.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that would change it for the better or not, but it would be a very interesting experiment because, you know, the tablet market and the phone market are very different. So I honestly don't know what would happen, but I'd like to see Google try, because I'd love to see how that would change the Android tablet equation, you know, for the better or for the worse. I don't know, but it's something that's worth trying. I think they should try it.
Well, you know, the one thing, you know, when you did this, you're going to do a travel article. And last week we talked about the fact that my daughter's going to Mexico, and I ended up doing a bunch of research online. First of all, I had AT&T unlock her phone because she could have it unlocked because she'd run out of her time limit, you know.
How long did that take you to get them to unlock her phone?
Well, they say it's not going to be done till Saturday, but we're going to test it today because it's probably done. But I ordered a SIM card for $30 and had it overnighted. So that cost almost as much as a SIM card, like $18. And put money into it already. And then when she gets down there, she'll send a text message to the network, and then she'll be able to add internet. And guess what? For 3 gigs of data, she'll be down there for 3 weeks or so. For 3 gigs of data, it'll cost her $38.88.
That's not too bad.
And it's a 3G network, so mostly in terms of where she'll be.
And yeah.
Well,
how many text messages and minutes does she get?
Well, it depends on how much we put in for the voice, but all she cared about was to have about 10 minutes of voice. But at any point she can, because we've set up an account on Telcel, she can send a text message and add money to it, or add more minutes, excuse me, more airtime. And, now contrast that to the fact that if we had bought her, data roaming from AT&T, 800 megabytes would have been $199.
Ouch.
So that's the difference. So by having an unlocked phone, buying this SIM, and I look at this and I just said to my wife, you know, when we get you a new phone, she has an iPhone 4, when we get you a new phone, we should just buy, or we should just get it unlocked and you take that with you when you go to Europe and just buy a SIM.
Yeah. And, I saved you $160, Steve.
You got it. You got it. I suppose you want your commission now.
No, I thought everyone knew about this.
It's hard to do, though. I mean, this is not trivial. Like, Julio, you couldn't like write an article about this and walk people through it, because it's not simple.
I think you nailed it. I literally tried to figure out. My wife has an older flip phone, and it. I spent three horrific days trying to figure out whether I could unlock the damn thing and just have my wife get a SIM when she got to the foreign country where she was traveling. And I could not for the life of me figure out whether that was possible. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to figure out.
Well, I found one guy who's from Canada that does a blog about data roaming. And he had a very detailed post, and he sent me to this, I'll put it in the show notes, Travelers Telecom. And this guy sends you SIMs, and he's got a free ebook that comes along with it and all kinds of stuff. And it's still incredibly geeky. I don't think he explains it well, and a lot of misspelled words and all that. But at the end of the day, it works and it's cheap.
All you need is a GSM phone that's unlocked. That's basically what you need. And then any foreign country you go to, for the most part, you can buy pay-as-you-go SIMs right at the airport as soon as you get there. Mm-hmm. And then you just put it in your phone and it connects to that network and off you go. And that's a lot cheaper than doing the international data roaming.
Right. Is this why AT&T offered to unlock old iPhones? Because there was such a demand from people to travel and do that?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, if you remember Fred Wilson, the VC that does, you know, he's got his famous blog, AB.
I know, is it ABC? Fred. Yep.
Well, he did the same thing about how he talked about when he took his family to Europe for a month one summer and how the kids burned up their $1,000 allotment in roaming in like a day.
Yep.
Was gone.
He can afford it, but.
Well, he can afford it, but.
He didn't enjoy that.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Well, and one other thing that I don't think a lot of people know is the Verizon iPad, the new one that I think you've got, Steve, right? You've got Verizon on yours?
Yep.
That has a GSM SIM slot in it that's totally unlocked. So if you get that one, that's actually better than the AT&T one, because AT&T is still locked to AT&T.
Right.
The Verizon one is totally open. Now, you can't just stick like your AT&T micro SIM into your Verizon iPad and have it work in the U.S. It doesn't. It's sort of locked out. I think it's more of a prioritization. So if it sees, you know, the iPad wants to connect to Verizon. So if it sees Verizon, it just connects to it and turns the GSM off.
Right.
But if you're in Mexico or UK or France or someplace, and you stick a foreign SIM in there, it'll connect to the foreign network without doing anything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I didn't know that. I told my daughter and she looked at me like, duh, of course. Yeah. I got me. Didn't you know that, Dad? I was like, no. So apparently that's been the case with all of the Verizon iPads from day one.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good, that means that if you're going to go 3G on the iPad or now 4G on the iPad, that Verizon is the only way to go.
Yeah.
The only one that makes sense anyway.
Well, Julio, really liked the preview of your article this Sunday in the Pioneer Press about travel technology, because it's I can't imagine people leaving their stuff at home. I mean, once you're doing it, especially if you're taking photos and you're using Instagram and sending stuff to Facebook or whatever, or you're tweeting and on and on and on, you want to have that thing with you when you, when you're traveling around. And it's not just that, but rather than schlep your laptop, you know, take your iPad.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is the second time I went on a big trip without a laptop. You know, my first instinct is always, you know, to pack a laptop because it's the fuller featured, more powerful computer compared to an iPad. But it always gets down to the fact that when I'm traveling, my computing needs aren't as heavy duty. They're lighter than they would tend to be when I'm sitting in my home office, as I am now, you know, in front of my iMac. And it's, I old habits are hard to break. I just love, you know, being on a traditional computer with a keyboard and all of that. But the truth be told, you know, the iPad is, in for many people in many circumstances, the ideal travel computer, because the higher pixel density of the screen makes a big difference, because you can just pack more information on there. You can see more of a document or a web page. The apps, yeah. The last time I went on a trip with an iPad only as an experiment, the apps just weren't there. I mean, apps, you know, sort of crucial apps like Blogsy for blogging just didn't exist.
Right.
Twitter apps left something to be desired. The sophistication and power and flexibility of the apps that are available for the iPad right now just blows my mind. And it makes the decision of whether to take an iPad only on a trip all that much easier. Android tablet users have a lot more difficulty with that decision because the quality of the apps isn't there. I mean, and I'm starting to wonder whether it ever will be there. Android apps for tablets just haven't really evolved the way they should have. But on the iPad, I mean, it's amazing. I've done this before. It's not the first time I've done this, but it blows me away every single time. I'm sitting in my parents' kitchen, you know, having a video Skype conversation with my family with the iPad on my lap, and I'm sitting there doing that. I'm saying, "Wow, we live in the future."
Yeah,
it's really cool.
Yeah, I know that column inches are limited, Julio, but did you leave out suggested apps that people should put on their phones for travel, or
on the phone versus the tablet?
Yeah, or both, really, because I'm just thinking that, you know, something like TripIt and some of the airline carrier applications are really indispensable when I'm traveling.
Yeah, and I didn't. My travel circumstances were fairly simple, so I'd never found any need for travel apps. Personally, yeah.
Well, there's an idea for another column for you.
Yeah, absolutely. But to your point, I was limited by column inches, and so what you see on the column isn't everything. I'm gonna blog about some additional gadgets, and related products. I took the latest Scott eVest. On the trip.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Did you slide your iPad into it?
Yeah, the classic Scott eVest is still for sale, but they rejiggered, you know, based on consumer feedback, they redesigned the vest and came out with a new, you know, version 2.0 vest, which has, I think, 24 pockets versus 22, which is ridiculous when you think about it. One key thing is it's a little thinner. The classic vest is a little on the thick side, and this one's a little thinner. It's really fun, you know, to walk up to the security area and have all your gadgets in your vest, and so all you have to do is take the vest off and put it on the conveyor, and you're done.
You know, the only downside was,
yeah,
I was going to buy one of these before we went to Europe, mm-hmm. and so I showed my kids and my wife a video of this, and my daughter looks at me and just goes, "Dad, are you going to wear shorts and black socks too? Because I'm totally not walking with you." It's like, thanks, honey. But I just got rations and rations of crap. And I thought it was cool. I mean, I thought, oh my God, imagine being able to put all that stuff in there. And anyway, so I just got such a bad time. Is this new one up on the website? Because it says with 22 pockets.
Yeah, I forget. Well, they have three vests right now: the classic, the brand new one, and they have a lightweight vest, which they're phasing out because their version 2.0 vest is also fairly lightweight. So at some point, they're going to be down to two vests, the original and the updated model.
Okay.
The updated model is very nice. I did, they made it lighter because people complained it was a little on the thick side. I did find even with the more lightweight construction, I found myself sweating a little bit as I made my dash to make flight connections and so forth. So I just, my advice to people is, you know, the vest actually may not be the best way to go when you're traveling, you know, to the airport and on planes. Where the vest really becomes useful is when you reach your destination and you're out and about. Like I took a Scotty vest on a trip to Silicon Valley, and I was just driving all over Silicon Valley. And with the cool weather, the vest was absolutely perfect. It kept me warm, had all the pockets. I didn't have any younger travel companions to give me grief. And it was perfect. Absolutely. So my sense is it may not be the best thing for airports, even though Scotty Vest bills it as such, but it's perfect when you get to Europe or the Orient or whatever, and you're out and about, and the usefulness of those pockets really comes home at that point, because as you know, when you're traveling, you're carrying a lot of stuff, maps and cameras and phones and so forth, and water bottles and so forth. And it really becomes perfect. You look like a complete dork, I admit, but it's worth it because of the functionality.
But some of us do without a vest, so it's probably not an issue.
Well, I hate to cut off the geek clothing discussion, but Phil needs to run, and he's at one of the events. So talk about Drupal Camp.
Yeah, Drupal Camp.
I was going to say, you know, I can just quietly drop off where you guys can feel free to mock me after I leave, since I am at Drupal Camp. So.
Well, we'll do that. Drupal Camp is just starting now, huh?
Just getting started with 2 days of Drupalness. So, yeah, I'll let you know how it goes. Again, I'm going in with an open mind as a WordPress guy, so we'll see what happens.
Where's Keller Hall?
Right on the street that is all torn up to bejeepers right now. So Washington
East
Avenue.
East Bank? Oh, okay.
East Bank,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Right next to the hotel and complex there. So,
sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Very nice facility. And looking forward to it. And I'll let you know how that goes. But other events are coming up as well.
And we'll review those.
Do.
Thanks,
guys. Right. Have a great one. Julio, great to talk to you again. Take care.
Hey, Phil, when you talk about Drupal camps of yours, do you go one time at Drupal camp?
Well, this is the way I'll have to talk about it from this point forward, I guess. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
See you later.
See you next week.
Well, you know, we've gone through these events, so we don't have to go through them again. But let's just, if we could, can we just spend another 2 minutes?
Sure.
And we're already over our allotted time, but I had Google lock me out of email, out of Gmail yesterday. Everything else is open, calendar and
all that. What did you do? What did you do to get locked out?
That's the interesting $64,000 question, Tim. I don't know. All of a sudden, I was back on about 2 o'clock. So it was about a 2 hour. They say it can go from 1 minute to 24 hours. And it was about a 2 hour thing. And I have no idea. All of a sudden, it was just back on, and everything is fine. Hmm. So that, and then again, that's the frustrating thing, because it's you know, is it going to happen again? And if it does, you know, is it going to happen at a mission critical time?
Do you have any idea how many people it affected, or are you just feeling like they singled you out for some reason?
If you do a Google search, so I'll put a link in the show notes from the post that I did on my own blog, but there are literally hundreds of others that this has happened to. Hmm. And the problem is that there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to wait until it comes back on, and you never know why they did it.
Well, I'm sure it's just like everything else with Google, it's an algorithm of some sort.
Precisely.
That thinks you've been hacked.
Yeah.
And so it's just protecting you.
Yeah.
I've used the Gmail since 2004. And I've never been locked out ever. And so I'm sure that it probably had something to do, like you said in your post, with you know, the multiple devices, and maybe you're logged in multiple places you know.
Well, all I want to know is, yeah, all I want to know is what I did to precipitate this so I can change my behavior or I can change my practices.
Steve, are you using the Google Apps version of Gmail or?
Well, no, I have my, this is the consumer version that everything is tied to. And then I have, I do have Google Apps for both Innovate Press and for our, the Trend Curve business. We each have, you know, there's Google Apps for those, but no, this is my consumer Gmail.
Because I always recommend when possible that people go Google Apps and in fact go the paid premium version of Google Apps.
So you can have a throat to choke.
Yeah, yeah. There's somebody to call. I was once locked out of my Gmail. I think the circumstances might have been different than yours, but nevertheless, I couldn't get into my Gmail. And this was the middle of the night, and it's like, can I call? Can I really call? And I called the number, and I got this guy in Australia, who solved my problem with the snap of a finger. And at that point, I vowed never to not use the paid version of Google Apps ever again.
Well, but the problem I've got is the sBorsch at Gmail is everywhere, and all of my services, Google Plus, everything is tied to it. And if I could figure out how to, you know, essentially push one button and point everything to a Google Apps version, I'd be dancing.
But while keeping the same address.
Well, not even, I don't, you know, I could forward the consumer Gmail version to whatever easily. But I just want to be able to not lose any juice or any presence that I've got. Anywhere. So now you love Google Apps. I mean, haven't you totally gotten behind it?
You're talking to me?
Yeah. For Gmail.
Yeah. One of the best things I've ever done, and I did it with a lot of trepidation, was transferring my personal domain name over to Google Apps. This was years ago. I was a Fastmail user at that point. And that went so well that I've been sort of dipping my toes ever deeper sort of into the Google pool, you know, very cautiously, because I didn't want to get burned, because Yahoo services burned me badly years ago. Yeah. And I took what for me is a fairly dramatic leap just a couple of weeks ago. I decided to completely abandon all desktop email programs, Outlook, Thunderbird, Mail app on the Mac. I don't use any of those anymore. I went straight to the Gmail web interface everywhere. On a Windows PC, if you're running Chrome, there's a little trick where you can create a standalone window for Gmail. On the Mac, you can use Fluid to create a Fluid app. So it sort of mimics a desktop experience, but I'm in the web interface 100% because the Gmail web interface has evolved to the point where it's very fast, very powerful. And I think it's superior to using a desktop mail client, and you don't have any of the configuration and malfunctioning hassles that you do is. That was another moment where I sort of swallowed 10 times and wondered whether I was crazy. But I've been on the Gmail web interface for weeks now, and I've never been happier. That's in fact, I redirect all my Pioneer Press work email to my Google Apps Gmail account and use that for work as well as for personal email.
Yeah, I love having everything there, because especially when I had to upgrade a version of Photoshop and I could not locate the serial number and it wasn't on my Adobe account, and I did a quick search in Gmail, and I've got, I don't know, 50,000 emails in there, and in like 3 seconds, boom, there it was.
Yep.
And yep. I love that. I just can't tell you. By the way, Fluid app, for those that don't know, it allows you to create site-specific browsers, and I use it all the time. I create a client-centric browser with all their stuff in tabs. And the only thing that I've noticed is I tried to create a Google-centric one, and it throws up on me and tells me all the reasons why I can't. You know, I wanted to use it for Google Apps, because the multiple sign-in thing within Chrome is always problematic. So I wanted to have, for my Trend Curve Google Apps and for my Innovate Press Google Apps, I wanted to have separate site-specific browsers.
Doesn't work, yeah.
For those, it doesn't work. It doesn't deliver. It defaults back to an old HTML-based Gmail client and so on, and it gives you a warning message that says basically you have an old browser here because it can't recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get around that?
Well, the problem I run into, I think it's the same problem you're experiencing, is Fluid has a default. If you have three Google accounts, it in the background has you logged into one of them, so you can't use the other two. So you can't create a standalone icon window for each of the three Google accounts. So I'm still stuck. You know, one of my gripes with Google is I started using Google Plus when Google Plus did not support Google Apps. So I started using Google Plus with an old generic Google account. Then Google opened up Google Plus to Google Apps, and then at that point I said, okay, fine. How do I migrate my Google Plus into my Google Apps, because that's where everything is. And Google's response at that point was, oh, you know, hang on, we'll have this fixed for you in a few weeks. And it's been like 7 months now. And this drives me absolutely insane, because it forces me to use multiple browsers. And so my current situation is almost everything Google is in Fluid. I have a Fluid icon for Docs. For Calendar and for Gmail and so forth, and that's all tied into my Google Apps account, because that's what Fluid sees. But then for Google Plus, I have to use Chrome. Logged into a different Google account, and it drives me batty.
Well, we'll continue this on. We got to wrap, boys. But it's been a great show, Julio. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, no problem. Sorry, circumstances didn't allow me to do it last time. I'm glad I got a chance this time.
Yeah, excellent. And Tim and Graham, thanks.
Yep.
You betcha. And
we'll see everyone next week on the Minovate Gang podcast.
See you then.
See you guys.
Take care.